Okay, well, comrades, we're going to discuss historical materialism. We've been working our way through this book. Not everyone will have been at the previous meeting where we discussed the philosophy of materialism and dialectics. So feel free to home in on them again. But by historical materialism, I mean the application of Marx's theory to the development of society. And what we did when we did philosophical materialism last time is we discussed idealism and materialism. And by idealism, we mean not what most people mean by idealism, but the idea that ideas are primary. Materialists, on the other hand, are also not the same as the usual meaning of the word, the common or garden meaning of the word. It means that we believe that matter is primary. In the beginning, there was matter, and that matter developed so that some of it became life, and that life forms in their turn evolved to develop thought and therefore ideas. Ideas come from matter, which is capable of thinking. Now, that is overwhelmingly obvious to me. It's also seems stupefyingly irrelevant. You know, do we need to know this? Well, we need to know this because we apply it to social development. We have the possibility that either the world we live in is the way it is because people are greedy and grabbing, in which case there is no point trying to change it because you can't change human nature, or we accept that if people are greedy and grabbing, then that is a way that you survive in a capitalist society. And if you change society, eventually you will change so-called human nature. And we believe that that is the thing. In other words, is it the case that consciousness determines being, or is it the case that being determines consciousness? And the foundation of our theory is that being determines consciousness. That the way we live determines the way we think. If we think back to the beginnings of humanity, 2 million years or so ago, we can ask ourselves what they were thinking of. Hegel described humans as thinking beings. That was his definition of how humans differed from other creatures. But we can accept that that's fair enough, but it doesn't explain what people were thinking about and why they were thinking. And if you imagine this caveman a couple of million years ago, is he thinking, why are we here? What's it all about? He's probably more likely to be thinking where his next meal's coming from. He would be thinking about staying alive. He would be thinking about gaining his daily bread. And we believe that the way human beings organise themselves to gain their daily bread is the skeleton of any form of society. Now, we also know that we did not get class. If humans have been on the planet a couple of million years, we have not had class society till round about the last 10,000 years. The vast majority of human existence, we have not lived in class society, and we can assume that our consciousness, the consciousness of those people, is very different because their conditions of being were so different. They lived in a situation that we call primitive communism. Now, the point about primitive communism is that you don't have a state. The state, as a separate bodies of armed men, is a creation of different class societies, as we shall see when we go through the different forms of class society. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have arguments. There's this bloke, Charlie, in HOV. There were people like Charlie, argumentative sods, under primitive communism, and we will probably still have people like that in advanced socialism. But the point is, although people will argue with each other, there wouldn't be a material basis for them arguing about. And that's why you have separate bodies of armed men in the state, in a class society, and you did not have that in primitive communism. People would just discuss among themselves. As I say, there would be differences of opinion. But there was, if you say, well, I think the wildebeestie is that way, somebody else might say it's that way, but you both have a material interest in finding out where they are. It's not as if you have conflicting interests about decisions, common decisions that are going to be taken. There's no private property in the means of production. These would be communally owned. Hunting grounds would be regarded as common. These people mainly lived by hunting and gathering. Some people say it's more correct to call it gathering and hunting. Since the women were, we can assume, were pregnant for quite a lot of the time, that ruled them out for running around after gazelles. And they actually did gathering, which arguably people were mainly vegetarian, and meat was a bit of an occasional treat. And of course the problem with hunting is it's a fairly insecure kind of existence. Whereas you can imagine rooting around for vegetables is a more, you know, is a way of at least filling your belly up in a fairly basic sort of way. Now, I don't know how far those pictures that we've all seen of, you know, blokes in the Ice Age waving flaming brands at terrified woolly mammoths and driving them into crevasses and then butchering them with stone bits of stone knife are, but that's the sort of thing. And you can imagine that to say that this piece of land is mine and this is somebody else's is fairly ridiculous. And your activity, the work activity, the activity of hunting a mammoth is collective. You know, you don't have one bloke with a flaming brand. It doesn't work, does it? You can't chase them into the crevasse. Likewise, when you've actually caught your mammoth, there is not much. It's a collective endeavour catching it. So everyone dives in when the mammoth is actually caught, because the mammoth is going to go off at some stage, so you might as well share it all around. And so they quite naturally had a sharing kind of economy. No private property in the means of production. May well have been private property in personal implements, but these were usually burnt or buried with the body after death. They would be regarded as personal. There was no question of passing private property on through the institutions of the family. I think we can assume that there was sex under primitive communism. There must have been, I suppose. But there wasn't the institution of the family, because the institution of the family is not just about legitimising sexual relations. It is essentially about passing on private property. And the institution of the family, and with it the subordinate position of women, comes with class society. So primitive communism, no state in our modern sense, no private property, and no institution of the family. Now, I'm going to deal with different forms of class society, but you shouldn't take this as an exhaustive list, and neither should you take it as an inevitable procession through history. I'm going to deal with slavery, feudalism, and capitalism. We did briefly mention the Asiatic mode of production. We can talk about that if you like, but I'm not going to deal with it in the lead-off. But if you take, for instance, the case of slavery, the main English language historian of the slave mode of production is a bloke called Moses Finley, and he says, well, he's dead now, but he said that there was really only five cases of slavery: Greece, Rome, the Caribbean, the southern states of the USA, and parts of Brazil. Now, clearly, those last three are slavery that sort of was rediscovered as part of early capitalism, so they're a bit different. But really, slavery was a thing confined to the Greco-Roman lands. I mean, Britain was actually colonised by ancient Rome, but I don't think that Britain under the Celts, under the Roman occupation, could be described as an example of the slave mode of production. It was fairly thinly colonised by the Romans. But that's a detail. The main point is that we don't see history as an inevitable succession of stages. And that's quite important, and we'll perhaps deal with that in the discussion. If we take slavery, What did we have? Well, we had private property in the land. We got the small proprietors were progressively driven off their land, and we see this very clearly in the case of ancient Rome, because they were outcompeted by huge estates that were where slaves did all the work, and those small farmers were progressively made propertyless in the case of ancient Rome. But who was the exploited class? Obviously, it was the slaves. You don't have to be Karl Marx to tell a slave that he's exploited, he or she. They know that. They're not being paid at all. In extreme cases, they will be whipped to death in a few years just to produce as much surplus as they can for their master. The master owns them body and soul, just buys them at an auction for life, in the usual way, until they choose to sell them on. So the slave is private property. Not only that, but there was private property in the land. There were rich Romans and there were poor Romans. And the rich Romans made sure that they passed their property on to their descendants through the institution of marriage. And marriage was a purely property arrangement, and nobody made much of a song and dance about it. Now, as far as the state was concerned, there were very different forms of the state. As we know, the Athenian ecclesia was fully democratic. You know, any free Athenian could turn up. Of course, free Athenians were outnumbered by foreigners called Dometics, who tended to be craftsmen but didn't have citizenship rights, and by the slaves. So there are actually only a few thousand people, but they did all vote. And yeah, anyone could turn up from the countryside if you're a free Athenian citizen, male citizen, I should qualify it, male citizen, and vote. On the other hand, you had just complete dictatorships in the Roman Empire, where one person apparently ran the show. But in all these cases, the state was a state of the ruling class. And the state actually only existed when the ruling class came into existence. Isn't it interesting? The first thing we know about so-called civilization is walled cities. You know, and they're building those walls for a reason, and that is to keep other people out and to keep something that they think is worth having inside. So the walled city and civilization itself is a product of the emergence of class society. Now, that emerged because we moved from hunting and gathering, in other words, going out there with a digging stick and hoping that there'll be crops there, to actually planting the crops. And we move from actually hoping that there's going to be game out there you eat, to actually putting the thing in a field and making sure it's there when the time comes to eat. And this enabled us to produce a surplus. Human beings could produce a surplus. Under primitive communism, they didn't work very hard, as far as we can work out. The poor old Kung people of the Kalahari Desert, who do live poor lives, they do live in a primitive communist existence, although they're continually touched these days by surrounding civilization. They apparently work top whack 20 hours a week. You know, they really don't see the need to knock their pipes out working any longer hours than that. They've got better things to do than work all week, and they do have a completely different mentality from us by all accounts. But anyway, the point is that they are producing a basic subsistence. When you get a surplus, the surplus is up for grabs. We say that it gets grabbed by the ruling class. The ruling class legitimises its rule by turning the means of production into private property, and that they defend that surplus with separate bodies of armed men, the state. And that is the case in all form of class society. Now, moving on to the feudal system, which emerged in Western Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire over a period of time, we see, again, private property in the means of production. The means of production is overwhelming the land. Feudal society was an overwhelmingly agricultural society. The ruling class, more or less, was the army. These were heavily armed knights on horses. I mean, there were also infantry with no armour and no horse, but obviously it wasn't a very even match between the two. So generally speaking, the ruling class was the state. Now, we're not interested in at this stage in talking about the details of the way that the society is organised. We're just trying to look at the basic structure of it. But under feudalism, you had exploitation, the same as you did of a slave. We like dealing with feudalism when we're dealing with economics, because the relations are so transparent, that you had these large open fields in throughout Western Europe, and they were divided into strips, and the peasant would work characteristically 3 days on his own land and 3 days on the lord's land. And you could actually see the surplus being put as grain, actually being put in sacks and taken up to the lord of the manor's castle, where him and his mates would eat it. So that was fairly clear that the peasantry were being exploited, and that you had a class-based society, and that class exploitation was based on private ownership of the means of production, in this case the land, as well as the slaves themselves. Now, how's about class struggle? There is class struggle in any class-divided society, but class struggle is different. The problem with slavery was there was a three-sided class struggle. There was a struggle between rich citizens and poor citizens, but the rich citizens and the poor citizens had this in common, that they were both citizens. And that if you're like a poor white in the southern states of the USA, well, you're white, and you regard that as more important than the fact that you're poor when it comes to keeping the slaves down. And that was the problem. I mean, the Roman proletariat was propertyless. They had been dispossessed. They started off peasants, but they'd been driven off their lands, and they lived as a sort of rabble. But they lived at the expense of society, which is the fundamental difference with the modern proletariat. As Alan says in his forthcoming book, they're actually more like a lumpen proletariat than a productive working class. So that was the problem. And when in the Communist Manifesto it says you either have the class struggle either leads to a new form of society or the mutual ruin of the contending classes, I think it's fairly clear that Marx and Engels had in mind what happened to the Roman Empire, where because the class struggle was three-sided, nobody actually won. Well, the ruling class won in the sense that they hung on, but the whole structure just decomposed over time. Now, in feudalism, again, you had a class struggle. The class struggle was about economics, and the peasantry were capable of being very rebellious. And we've had huge peasant movements in most European countries at one time or another. The problem with the peasantry was, first of all, that they were economically scattered, so that it was the peasants would rise up one place, and the peasants 10 miles down the road didn't know what was going on. But more important than that, they tended to be divided as a class between themselves. As commercial relations and trade developed, some peasants would develop capitalist aspirations, whereas others would progressively lose their land, be sunk to the ranks of the proletariat. So the peasantry have shown themselves incapable throughout history of playing an independent revolutionary role. They're incapable of playing a revolutionary role, but behind one or another class. In the classic bourgeois revolutions, they followed the bourgeoisie and the urban petty bourgeois. In the Russian Revolution, of course, they followed the working class. Then we come to capitalism. Now, under capitalism, there is also exploitation. I'm just going to take that as an obvious fact now, because we're going to deal with the economics later on as a sort of third component part of Marxism. But it looks different and it's concealed. You may do nothing but be a bookbinder and produce books all day. You're a working you're a working class because you have no access to the means of production. The only way you can make a living is by living is by working for someone else. If you could make enough money by working for 10 years as a bookbinder that you could buy enough shares to retire, then the capitalist system would disappear. But you can't do that. Obviously, workers in the 21st century in the advanced capitalist countries have much higher living standards than they did at the time of Charles Dickens. That's nothing to be ashamed about. We won those conditions through struggle. And the working class that makes a revolution won't be a desperate class, it will be a confident class that is, you know, knows that it can make gains and knows that it needs to hang on to those gains. So the working class is exploited, but the exploitation is concealed in the sense that you are propertyless, that you have that slightly different from a medieval peasant who would have their own plot of land, which on the one hand would be, they could say, well, this is my plot of land. On the other hand, they weren't allowed to escape from it. You know, they would actually have a peasant hunt if you tried to run off to the town. Now, when you're a worker, you don't have anything to fall back on. On the other hand, at least in formal terms, you're free. You can chuck your notice in, but you'll end up going to work for someone else. So it's the same difference. The ruling class between themselves have a monopoly of the means of production. Exploitation is concealed because you go into a factory and you produce books that you may not be in the slightest bit interested in, you know, crystallography or something like that. You don't know what bloody hell they're about. You're not required to know what they're about. You just buying them, that's all. And the boss comes to that, as it shares your indifference towards crystallography. He is not interested in it, but he does know that these books sell, that there's a certain number of university students are studying whatever crystallography is, and that they need to read these books to pass their exams. And so you just sell the output. So it's not obvious to you, and it's the same way it is with a peasant who's got two sacks of grain, one for his family and the other one for the lord of the manor, that you're being exploited. But you are being exploited. Now, the ruling class is different from the ruling class under feudalism, because they don't own land. I mean, there is a stratum of landlords as well under capitalism. But mainly they own money. And they own money, and therefore they can buy the means of production. And the definition of a capitalist is someone who's wealthy enough to live through their owning the means of production. That's the definition. And obviously, in any form of class society, there are various sort of transitional and intermediate forms of people who are quite wealthy but can't actually live on their own. Historically, there has been a petty bourgeois class in capitalism, people who both own and earn. So the working class gets its living through earning, through working, and the ruling class makes its living through its ownership. And there are people who own small shops, peasants who own small farms and things like this. But the general tendency of capitalism is to destroy these people's livelihood, because the difference with the capitalist system from previous forms of class society is it actually develops the productive forces. The tendency on the part of the ruling class in feudalism was to say, well, since production was fairly stagnant, they would say, what I need to do is to exploit more peasants. And so they would have a war against a lord of the manor somewhere else. Now, as you can probably work out, this is a zero-sum game. You know, that all this does is actually destroy a large part of the surplus in stupid wars which do not develop the productive forces. Now, what the capitalist says is not how can I exploit more workers, but how can I exploit workers more? How can I get the workers to produce more? And there is this tendency to develop the productive forces inherent in capitalism. And we say that's tremendously progressive, because we have the situation now, I think it's official, we have more than 1 billion workers in the world. Okay. Now, if you add in their dependents, that means there's about 2.5 billion people. We're getting towards a majority. There's still a lot of people who are intermediate stages, but the tendency is towards proletarianisation, towards more and more of the toiling population becoming propertyless and becoming members of the working class. Now, on the other hand, you have the capitalist class developing the powers of production. So I did try and work out how many people there were that produced textiles in this country. I think there's about half a dozen factories. There's ICI produces artificial textiles, as we used to call them, and there's something called Carrington Viella, which is Coates and Viella and loads of old firms like that, all amalgamated. And then there's there's about four or five, I think, companies producing textiles. Now, try and contrast that with the situation that we had at the beginning of the 19th century, a time before Marx was writing, when there were 250,000 handloom weavers in Britain. So you can still see these cottages out in the north sometimes, where these blokes are sitting on their own, clanking away, you know, producing cotton textiles. for the world, actually. And there are 250,000 of these people. Now, imagine you had a socialist revolution at that time, and then you tried to integrate these guys into a socialist plan. It'd been quite difficult, wouldn't it? You know, 250,000 handloom weavers, issuing them instructions. There are ways you can actually do this sort of thing. You can have a universal buying corporation that can actually encourage peasants to produce one crop rather than another by offering them different prices. So you can knit people into a plan of production without actually expropriating them, as long as you own the main means of production yourself. But my point is, now there's only about half a dozen textile companies, and it's absolute DOS, isn't it, involving them in a plan of production. You just take them over, integrate them into one, you know, textile trust or whatever you call it, and you work out what you need. And that's not that difficult. If you think of anything in the world like carpet, I mean, there's a certain number of people who are moving house, which is actually predictable. They go in and they think, oh my god, I'm not having this carpet these people who was in here before had. And there's a certain amount of carpet that's going to wear out, and you can actually sit down and work out how much carpet needs to be produced in a year, and things like that are actually fairly predictable. And certainly with computerisation, the problems are not overwhelming. But one precondition is, you can't have a proper plan unless you have the involvement of the working class. I mean, it's not really a plan if you're just telling them what to do, as happened in Russia, where you had all kinds of abominations as a result of that. You know, the classic one is, you would tell them you wanted 28 tons of nails. You could do these calculations, and there was a cartoon in the 1960s about the Russian workers bringing one 28-ton nail out because they'd achieved their target. You know, you said 28 tons of nails, so here it is, one big nail weighing 28 tons. And so the bureaucrat would sit down and think, nah, they fooled me that time. I know, I'll write a more detailed description. And then you get all these... Then the nails would all come out the same size, and they were the wrong size because that was the easy thing for them to do. And so you'd say, no, I want an assortment. And you'd make all these rules for assortment, and it would just become totally ridiculous. But the reason it was ridiculous is because you were trying to make their lives harder for them, and they were basically trying to make their lives as easy for themselves as possible. In other words, there were still conflicts of interest with the bureaucracy. But in principle, capitalism develops the productive forces so that we can move to a society of abundance. We're on the threshold of a society of abundance. The thing that caused class society, if you can use that word, the thing that made a class society inevitable was the fact that there was not enough to go round. And that is no longer the case. At least in potential, we have the possibility to give everyone a decent standard of living. But, I mean, I think you only have to look at the way the capitalist system is evolving, and that it's never going to give it to us. In fact, if we take power in the next main capitalist countries in the next 30 years, I think we've got a problem on our hands. So there are people already fighting each other with wars about water. Environmental degradation and things like that will be that much more advanced. We will have a bit of a job on our hands, but we can and will see our way through it. But the point is that the capitalist system develops the preconditions for a higher socialist order. It develops a mass working class, which is a class which knows that its only power is through its unity. And so it develops a collective consciousness. Not always, I have to say. I mean, Ben was amazed when I told him that in ordinary capitalist concerns, they have tea clubs where people come around and collect 50 pence off you and go out and buy the tea and coffee. I don't know why it don't work here, but even in ordinary capitalist institutions, working class people do that sort of thing. They cooperate on the shop floor at quite a mundane level to make their lives a little bit easier for each other. They know that they're not going to become capitalists. You, as a worker on the shop floor, know that you can't become a capitalist. You know that the way you're going to improve your standard of living is through common action against your boss. And you start to see beyond that that it's not a matter of just your boss, but the boss class who are the obstacle. So capitalism creates a possibility of abundance, and it creates a class which can take over production and actually run it in the interests of all society.